Nimrod!
Catapult of propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and get us.
PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to our bunker on the final day of May.
That's right. So tomorrow's June, and the Cubs are going to turn everything around. No, they're not. I'm just kidding.
Honey,
anyway.
They might.
Yeah.
They might.
And monkeys.
They might. they'll hit the field with their hats on backwards.
That's
We're
right.
turning everything around.
Well, speaking of new looks.
Huh?
If you haven't had a chance yet to visit the main peeringintodarkness.com website page, do so today. Get a look at the new sleek news of the
makeover
official
shows?
Security team. Yeah, we did makeovers
we
on the dogs.
Makeovers
today.
On the dogs. Go to PID Home, and you'll see the new look for Java. Now, Murphy's had this before, so some of you may have seen the sleek Murphy look, but they've got their summer hairdos going, and they're looking pretty good.
Yeah, St. Louis gets pretty hot and muggy in the summertime.
Oh,
we've got a lot of water here. You'd think in the middle of the U.S. we wouldn't be as muggy and warm as some places on the coast.
Yeah, but we have three rivers.
Well, yeah, of course, the two biggest, the Missouri and the Mississippi,
and
come
the
together right here. And the Merrimack, that's sort of a throw-in. You know, it only really functions as a river.
It's like a big creek, I know.
Yeah,
but still, it's, you know.
Middle of March to about the end of May.
It's like the Platte River in Nebraska.
Yeah. Yeah, in the spring, it's a river. The rest of the summer, it's, you know, you can't even go floating on it because you scrape
it. Yeah, but there's a lot of water around here.
Yeah, there is, and it's up in the air in the summer. So the dogs will be a lot more comfortable with their new dos. And we appreciate you being here today as we begin the final day of the month of May. We continue our prophecy series with the beginning of a new interview with Peter Goodgame. And this is really interesting because he kind of builds on the stuff that we've talked with him about before. And very timely, I'll mention that his Giza Discovery book, which is a manuscript that is being rounded into form for publication, but he's been putting it on the internet as sort of a work in progress with all of his footnotes and all of the diagrams and everything, all of the
graphics. Very few writers do that.
Very few writers do that. I mean, we are a pretty jealous bunch, and we're just wanting
you
people to
see
take
it when I'm getting ready.
That's, yeah,
and that'll
exactly
be when it's published.
Yeah, but Peter, you know, God love him, has put the information up on the web. And Terry Melanson, who is the publisher of the Conspiracy Archive website, has posted it and put a link to it. So
if you
stop in at the Conspiracy Archive, which is an amazing collection.
Oh, gosh, there's so much stuff there.
Excellent, excellent articles about the research that goes into, and we're talking scholarly research into the topics that we discuss here. Do check it out. And while you're there, make sure you click the link for the Giza Discovery by Peter Goodgame. By the way, Terry Melanson's got a book coming out soon, and we do want to talk with him when he gets it published. It's about the Illuminati. It's a scholarly history of the Illuminati.
You know, I think that is absolutely something we're lacking right now, because we refer to it all the time.
Right.
And we get emails. Can you explain to us what the Illuminati
right.
is? It's difficult to answer in one email because it is an historical and worldwide notion.
And it's a term that gets thrown about, like New World Order, that is applied too broadly. And is not well defined. So Terry has got this in the works. It should be out. It's coming out, as I understand it, from the same publisher that brought us Peter Levenda's books.
Essentially, it boils down to Gnostics with power.
Yeah. Yes, that's a good point. We've got the first part of Peter Goodgame's interview coming up in a few minutes. And in the news today, interesting things. Of course, we're still making overtures toward Iran, but on our own terms, of course.
Yeah. Oh, of course, the reply was, oh, yeah?
And that's kind of the way it goes. We did the same thing with Milosevic in Serbia. We did the same thing with, you know, anytime.
This is a diplomatic dance, and everybody involved who's been around for any time at all, they all know what they're doing.
Yeah,
they all know it's a dance.
Condoleezza Rice basically made an offer that he couldn't possibly accept. And so, you know, things will continue, but it's designed to make him look like him being Ahmadinejad look like a bad guy in the eyes of the world. There was a very interesting op-ed piece that came out in the LA Times earlier this week. And I referred to it the other day, and I hadn't found it until today. But it's really well done, and we recommend it. That's why we put it at WatcherMagazine.com. Because it, again, puts the news of today into a bit more historical context, which helps us understand what's going on.
Right. If you want to think about politicians today, just picture that Eagle of Lagash.
Yeah.
The phoenix with the two heads.
Right.
Because that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the same critter looking one direction 1 minute and the other direction the other minute.
And both directions at the same time.
That means the head's spinning.
Yeah, yeah, which is what most of us do, and we just throw up our hands in despair and and pull the lever for straight whatever party of our choice. It should be the same. The symbol of Russia is this double-headed eagle. And, of course, we've mentioned it's also the symbol for 32nd, 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemasons. It should be the symbol of the United States instead of the eagle because...
It should be. In fact, it almost was.
Yeah, and it would be very appropriate if it was because that is the way our political system is laid out. Democrat, Republican, those are your two choices. Well, what about Constitution Party, Libertarian Party, Green Party, Reform Party?
You throw in your vote away.
You're throwing your vote away.
I'm voting for Kang.
That's right. Don't blame me. I voted for Kodos. You didn't see any of those political candidates, the candidates from those other parties in the last presidential election because they couldn't get FaceTime at any of the televised debates. The League of Women Voters, which is supposedly in charge of these debates, refused to let them on. Well, they're fringe candidates. They can't get on. Well, how are they ever going to build a base if they're never offered an opportunity to speak their mind in a public forum?
Exactly.
No, it's because the Republicans and the Democrats are the two heads on this double-headed eagle, and they're cooperating, they're pulling in the same direction, they're reading from the same script. And this piece by Jacob Heilbrunn from the LA Times documents the history, it just touches on it anyway. He's writing a book about the neoconservatives, the neocons, but he points out that there are a number of young Turks in the Democratic Party that sound an awful lot like the neocons, and then he goes back about 20 years or so to the Reagan years in which a group who had recently moved to the Republican Party from the Democratic Party were just on the rise. Guys like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and William Kristol and his father. Basically, it's a group that wants to take the Democratic Party, a group today like Peter Beinart, the editor of the New Republic, Will Marshall, who's from the Progressive Policy Institute, guys who sound very hawkish and want to take the Democratic Party to the right. And it just goes to show what we've been saying all along, that the neocons are not part of either political party. They're behind the scenes, and they'll work with whichever party happens to be in power to get what they want.
By the way, just in case you don't understand the term Young Turks, it doesn't necessarily mean A, that they're Turkish,
right,
or B, that they're Rod Stewart fans.
That's true.
Well, you know what? If Princess Diana, she hasn't been in the news for a while. I just had to put her in there because we've had a dearth for months and months. Apparently, there's new evidence, and I say apparently because the Sir John Stevens, who is saying this, has a book to sell. So, you know, he's got to do something that makes the book sound new and different. But he claims that there is new forensic evidence, fresh. Forensic evidence.
They freeze dried it.
But this is something that in one of these days I'd like to have someone on who really has looked into all of this because there are aspects of this that really do sound like they are conspiratorial. You know, the fact that it took place at the Pont d'Alma, which is a place where historically the Merovingian kings would come to sacrifice somebody. And she supposedly was a descendant with Merovingian blood from the Stuart line, and she therefore brought a Merovingian heir to the throne of England.
That'd be Prince William.
That would be Prince Will I Am.
Will.i.am, who could be King Arthur.
Who could be King Arthur. That's one of his names, so he could very well call himself King Arthur.
The once and future king.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And he is very handsome and personable and, mm-hmm. you know, all the things that his mother was.
Yes, and that his father is lacking.
And, of course, his younger brother looks nothing like his father.
Hmm.
Nothing like Diana's husband. Nothing like Prince Charles.
We'll just let that one lie.
Doesn't really look much like his mother. So there you go. Well, you know, that rumor's been floating around for a long time anyway. Well, also, we've got the FBI wants to expand its database. And the reason they want to is to make sure that they can identify all those bodies.
Hmm.
There are way too many bodies going unidentified.
I thought it was because they were just afraid the NSA was getting a leg up.
I suspect
they've got
that's
more
really
names in their files than we do.
I suspect that's really what's going on. Well, when I posted this story to Watcher Magazine this morning, I also posted a link to a related story where Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York called for a U.S. worker DNA database.
Yeah.
Lest we forget, he did that.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of people out there saying, we need more DNA.
Yeah,
we give need us your DNA. You can bet now. I bet you now hospitals routinely
are taking DNA and saving
it. You betcha.
Yeah. Well, we need to have everybody. You know, it is interesting that Bloomberg called for that, you know, basically creating a national DNA database of all legal workers in the U.S., citizens mm-hmm. or non-citizens. Somehow he thinks that's logistically possible. And yet deporting the alleged 11 million
exactly.
undocumented workers is not doable.
Can't do it.
No, we can't take out the 11 million, but we can take a DNA sample of the 150 or so working American million working.
Of course, the real ID is going to come into reality mm-hmm. very mm-hmm. soon.
Yep.
All states have to comply with the new biometric database.
Mm. Well, a couple of interesting anomalous type articles to throw. Yes, to
as
throw
in,
out here.
Tom Horn's magazine or anomalous?
Fit anomalous, and they would fit right into anomalous. Dan Aykroyd is out pitching a new DVD.
Mr. Webtoes!
Yeah, I'd forgotten that he had those Webtoes.
I remember that when I was a big fan of Saturday Night Live way back in the day, early on. Mm-hmm. I just thought Dan Aykroyd was the best one on the show, and I remember reading an article about him one time, and he mentioned the fact that he had Webtoes.
Well,
you don't forget that.
No, that is something you don't forget. And actually, as his career's gone on, I've gained more respect for him as an actor.
Oh, he's a fine actor.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't think so when he did The Blues Brothers.
Well, you grow.
I mean,
you learn, you take some classes.
He did. He was great in Driving Miss Daisy.
Frankly, putting on some weight, I think, helped him a lot.
Yes. Well, he's now marketing a DVD in which he talks about his long-running interest in UFOs and ufology. There's no jokes in the DVD. It is just a serious discussion of the evidence. They show a lot of film clips and film footage and interview UFO experts like David Serrata. So that is something that you can find out about. A lot of stories on the web. We'll put a link to the Reuters story on that.
We'll have to get a copy of that.
That should be interesting.
Yeah.
And the Toynbee tiles are in the news again.
The Toynbee tiles.
Not that anyone's discovered anything new, but there's a new article in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about the Toynbee tiles. This is a really weird story. If you've not heard of these, the Toynbee tiles are...
We heard of these over a year ago. Maybe a couple of years ago. We were looking all over the internet on them.
Mm-hmm. They're linoleum tiles that have been embedded in asphalt on streets around the country. There, so far, have been 150 or more of them that have been found. And they have... They basically are variations on the same message. The picture in the article that I'll link to in the show notes here says, Toynbee idea in movie 2001, resurrect dead on planet Jupiter. And then below in small letters it says, you must make and glue tiles.
Okay.
There's another one. Toynbee ideas in Kubrick's 2001, resurrect dead on planet Jupiter. And... again, there are about 150 of these tiles that are all over the place. There's
a
website
on the internet. Yeah.
In fact, there's a website, Toynbee.net, T-O-Y-N-B-E-E, Toynbee.net, which has pictures of these from all over the country. But this article in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette was because they've got a couple of them in Pittsburgh, and so I guess Slow News Day or something, they decided to put the article out there. But the thing is, nobody knows where these come from, who started the idea, or who's behind this thing. They're named for Arnold Toynbee,
Their links to the images are broken.
That's too bad. Could be they've got a lot of hits after the article in the Pittsburgh paper.
Oh, that's probably
Arnold J. Toynbee was a British historian, but nobody really knows why somebody took it upon themselves to start taking these linoleum tiles and embedding them into asphalt. Nobody knows who's done it and how they managed to do it without being spotted, I guess. So we'll put a link to that. It's an interesting mystery. And
like crop circles.
Like crop circles, sort of a 21st century thing. You know, crop circles, instead of doing it in the fields, they just put it right there in the asphalt.
I'm not going there.
Okay. Let's move offshore. The Persian Gulf. The Iranians apparently buzzed one of our aircraft carriers with one of its drone planes for about 25 minutes the other day.
Yes. Now, I find this really interesting, and I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that Condoleezza Rice came out today and said, oh, we'll talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because when that letter came from Ahmadinejad, the answer was no.
Yeah. Talk?
We're not talking.
Now, the plane was finally spotted after it had been, spying on the USS Ronald Reagan for about 25 minutes. But by that time,
it could have unloaded who knows what.
If it had been equipped with a missile.
Yes, yeah. Or even just a biological weapon or leaflets or anything. Sure. I'm surprised they didn't have leaflets to just drop down and say, hi.
Yeah.
This could have been a bomb.
Or could have said, resurrect dead on Jupiter.
Or join me. Yeah.
So the question that has to be asked is, how did they manage to get a plane close enough to circle over one of our aircraft carriers, which is the size of a floating city, for 25 minutes?
I think that's a really good question. I assume that the aircraft carrier radar isn't used to looking for tiny things like that, but they well should be, because UAVs are pretty common these days.
Yeah. Well, that's what we've been using to... the Predator drones are what we've been using to launch attacks on targets in Afghanistan and Iraq. So it's conceivable that it's large enough that it could carry a missile of some sort that could really do a lot of damage.
Well, exactly. And in fact, I linked to another news story where it says that Iran has been seeking Western technology to enhance its UAV program. They want something that can carry a payload.
Mm-hmm. And they've at least proved what they've done today, or within the last couple of days anyways, they've executed what they call proof of concept. We've now shown that we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. Maybe that had something to do with Condoleezza saying, okay, we'll talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because somewhere you would assume that the message got from the guys in the field to the White House that, hey, they can get close enough to launch something without us spotting it.
Oh, yeah. You know, also, as far as terrorism goes, one of our listeners, John, sent in a story coming out of Berlin, and this is something we really haven't been talking about, and that's that the Berlin Games are going to be coming up really fast here, the World Cup. And that's something that almost everybody except for the United States gets excited about.
Yeah.
Venezuela's going to go just mad about it. They love that stuff down there. But it's going to be held in Berlin this year. And if we all remember, if you've forgotten, the movie was just out last year, how in Hamburg, Germany, during the Olympics, there were terrorist actions. And quite a number of Israeli athletes were kidnapped, held hostage, and killed. And... this is a story of a young man who decided to take his knife and wield it in a crowded building. And he managed to injure 28 people before he was taken down. Here's the twist. One of his first victims was an AIDS carrier. So the blood on the knife could well have carried that AIDS virus to the other victims.
Yeah. That's something that you have to think about today. Well, that's why they're so careful anymore, even
in basketball.
Pro sports,
yeah.
Hockey, basketball, football, if somebody starts to bleed, if somebody gets cut, which can happen when you've got big, strong guys that are getting physical, everything stops until they get that guy off the court or off the field. Going back a couple of days, there was a court case that we didn't have time to touch on last night, but it is worth noting. The Supreme Court ruled on Tuesday by a 5-4 vote that whistleblowers, government whistleblowers, are not protected by free speech rights. This doesn't necessarily mean that they're open to being punished if they speak out. But
I think they could be. They could be threatened with loss of job.
Well, the case was brought by a prosecutor from the Los Angeles prosecutor's office who argued that he was demoted, denied a promotion, and transferred because he tried to expose a lie by a county sheriff's deputy in a court case, a search warrant affidavit, I guess. And the court ruled that because whistleblowers should be protected under laws specifically for government whistleblowers, that the First Amendment argument that his speech was protected under the First Amendment of the Constitution was not a valid argument. However,
it's kind of hard to tell from exactly what happened.
And not being a legal expert, you know, we're certainly not up on the nuances here, but it does seem that this kind of a case, that this ruling could put a damper on people who might be inclined to step forward if they see something going on that's wrong.
Well, exactly. And the judicial system relies heavily on case law, which means that if there has been a precedent where some other judge has ruled a certain way, that is just like your legislator and mine sitting down and creating a brand new law. It has just as much weight. Apparently, this decision essentially says that whatever you are asked to do at work, you must do, and if you try to complain about it, you are not protected. You do not have a free speech right to complain about it or to rat on your boss.
It's like everybody's working in Las Vegas. What happens there stays there.
What? Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I know.
I hate those ads.
Well, as we head to the Middle East, as we discuss Peter Goodgame's research into the history of that part of the world and how it relates to prophecy about that part of the world, we should make note of a story that is going to get even bigger from that part of the world. Military officials in the U.S. say that their internal investigation has determined that the 24 people killed in the town of Haditha were, in fact, shot.
They were indeed shot. That's what the videotape shows.
And the original story by the Marine Corps was that they were victims of a roadside bomb. So the fact that they were shot, you know, pretty well puts that story to the lie.
I know.
Or puts the lie to that story is what I meant. And so there will be trials forthcoming, it sounds like, and this is a very disturbing story. And we just pray that there aren't more of these that come to light.
I know.
I mean, not. I shouldn't say it that way. Let's pray that there aren't more
of these that
have
happened. Exactly.
If they have happened.
No more happen at all.
Yes. If things like this have happened, they should come to light. And those responsible should be punished.
Right.
And I think you said it very well. This could be our generation's Me Lai.
Or No Gun Ri.
Or No Gun Ri. Absolutely.
Which is from the Korean War. Well, we have an excellent interview coming up for you. Peter Goodgame has been with us before, and if you have not listened to the archive interviews, go back and listen to them as
Absolutely.
Soon as you finish listening to this series. He has so many unique and unusual insights into prophecy, and I think you're going to be delighted to hear what he has to say.
Yeah. Unusual, though, not in the sense that
they're whacked out.
Speculative or off the wall.
No, no.
He does have some very creative and unique ideas here, but they're all grounded in evidence, and he will take you through them step by step as much as time allows. And, of course, we do encourage you to get his book, Red Moon Rising, and then check his website for the Giza Discovery, because it's just amazing stuff.
Yep. So here is part one with Mr. Peter Goodgame.
The author of Red Moon Rising and the forthcoming book, The Giza Discovery, which is available in its outline form more or less on the internet right now, in fact. Peter Goodgame. Peter, thank you for joining us again on PID Radio.
Hello, Derek. Good to be with you.
Well, we needed to have you in here as we continue through our prophecy series leading up to 66 of 06, and it's because of your excellent book, Red Moon Rising, which makes a very persuasive case for a logical timeline for the apocalypse, but also for the ideas that you put forward in the forthcoming book, The Giza Discovery, about the identity of the Antichrist, which is really interesting, especially for me, because I've got an interest in ancient Near Eastern history anyhow. So what we'd like to do for the next few segments here of interviews is to kind of go through these connections, show the parallels, the connections between the literature and the belief systems of the ancient Near East to the ancient Hebrews, which, of course, is recorded in the Bible, and how that then comes full circle and relates to future events, what is going to happen in the future. So when we go back and we look at history as recorded in the Bible, we see that these same stories were recorded in the ancient Near East, did we not?
Yes, in ancient Sumer. Now, the Sumerians were the very first people to write. They invented writing, essentially. About 2800 B.C. was the final involvement of a useful form of writing that could write down narratives. And so it's very important just for human civilization as a whole to read what these Sumerians had to say about all different kinds of things, but most especially about their belief system, what they believed in, what they worshipped, what was their religion, and what were the stories, what were their ideas about how humankind came to be on this earth.
Now, just as a point of reference, we didn't have access to the writings of the ancient Sumerians until pretty recent times, right?
Yes, it was. I would say it was the mid-1800s when all of these ancient sites were excavated, and everything started coming out in a flood. All these texts, all these ancient temples with their cuneiform clay tablets.
Mm-hmm.
That clay tablets basically last forever, and it's lucky for us that was the first type of medium used to record writing was baked clay tablets, and I think it's another one of those coincidences that help us understand the important questions.
Okay, so these sites geographically are pretty much located in modern Iraq.
Yes, the Mesopotamian rivers, valleys, yeah.
Where the world's attention is focused again today. Okay, so these clay tablets were discovered with this ancient writing, and it lays out their belief systems or just ancient legends. How were they interpreted when the writings were discovered?
When they were discovered, it was like the post-Enlightenment era where everybody was becoming skeptical of religion, of spirituality, of the supernatural. You know, most people had, at least academics, had a very materialistic perspective. So it was essentially discarded as myth. I mean, not discarded, but written off as myth. It was it wasn't really understood how profound the writings of what they were telling, the story that the Sumerians were telling. They didn't realize how it all fits in.
Now, scholars who believed in the literal truth of the Bible, how did they interpret the discovery and the publication of these ancient Sumerian texts?
Well, they did what was obvious. The truth is that of all the ancient pagan cultures, when you look at Greece, Rome, Egypt, wherever, it was the ancient Sumerians that had a story that was most closely resembled the story told at the beginning of the book of Genesis. Because they talked about, very clearly, they pinpointed when the flood took place, and they talked about the creation of man, and they had similar stories such as the Cain and Abel story, and also stories that my research has kind of shown as the Tower of Babel, the story of the Tower of Babel, Nimrod, all of these things were in the ancient Sumerian tablets.
Mm-hmm. They record a great flood?
Yes, they did. The Sumerian king list is very clear. It lists the first few dynasties from before the flood, and then it says, and then the flood swept over, and then it begins a new list of dynasties.
Okay. So a biblical perspective would indicate that you're seeing the same story told from a different viewpoint.
Yes. Now, a case in point here is on the Sumerian king list, what it talks about, the beginning of human government, essentially. It talks about how the very first city ever built was the city of Eridu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then the second is this, it was another city. The name slips my mind right now. But let's concentrate on Eridu. According to the book of Genesis, the very first city ever built was built by Cain for his son.
Mm-hmm.
Enoch, okay? Enoch had a son named Irad, and that is where we get the name Eridu from. Eridu and Irad are very similar. The meaning of the Hebrew meaning of Irad is to descend.
Oh.
And that's what it says in the Sumerian king list, that the kingship descended from heaven at Eridu. That was the first city ever built, and that's where kingship descended from heaven. And there's a supernatural implication here. Because that's where they believe that the divine right to rule came directly from the gods, the Sumerian gods.
Okay, so we're talking about the Anunnaki now.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so you see the parallel then between the Anunnaki as what we, in with a biblical worldview, would see as the first few verses of Genesis chapter 3. Or
yes.
Chapter 6, rather. Six.
Yes, chapter 6 and earlier, though. Yeah, the Anunnaki are the sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who came down are the ones who fell, who descended and had sexual relations with women and bore the Nephilim. Yes, that's absolutely how it works. Now, the Sumerian pantheon, there's like a trinity at the top, let's say. The high god is referred to as Anu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And under him, there's another, the next generation. The primary two gods under him are Enlil and Enki. And if we compare this with Scripture, and I go through this in detail in my Giza Discovery series, and to make a long story short, Enlil really seems to play the part of Jehovah or Yahweh, in that he is the effective ruler of the divine council, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He's also the one who is responsible for the flood, for bringing the flood. And then Enki seems to play the part of Satan. And this is something that I go into detail, and this really has a lot of serious implications when you just examine the whole corpus of Sumerian literature. And what I've found essentially is that the Sumerian history of the stories told in Sumerian literature, their myths, everything seems to revolve around glorifying Enki. And throughout the myths, you see, stage by stage, there's a consistent pattern of trying to erode the power of Enlil, and trying to it's like very irreverent. They become very irreverent toward him, and near the very end, essentially Enlil is removed as the effective leader of the pantheon, and in his place comes Marduk. That is the god really promoted big time by Hammurabi,
mm-hmm.
who established the Babylonian dynasty about 1700 to 1800 BC. But it's a step-by-step attack on Enlil to try and remove him from the picture. Now, Anu is a strange case because Anu is the high god,
mm-hmm.
but he's essentially an Otios deity. It's like he's removed from the picture.
Otios means basically
Otios
uninvolved.
Uninvolved.
Okay.
He's a figurehead.
Okay.
And what I think is that the memory of the ancient Sumerians, they had a memory of Jehovah after the flood,
mm-hmm.
but after the division of the nations, and hopefully most of your listeners are familiar with this concept of the division of the nations, because it's very important. This is something pioneered by Mike Heiser,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the idea that after the Tower of Babel event, that God kind of stepped back from the scene and allowed, as kind of like a judgment on humanity, he allowed the fallen angels to take control of the nations of the world. God simply, essentially said that he'd had enough, and that mankind was continuing to be rebellious, typified by the actions of Nimrod and the building of the Tower of Babel. That's what led to it. But that's how paganism began, is when the fallen angels were allowed to take over the nations of the world. And that's why, from that moment on, the Creator was tried to, there began this process of trying to eliminate the Creator,
mm-hmm.
from mankind's memory.
Well, Nimrod is a fascinating character because his memory has echoed down through the ages and is remembered, in fact, in the symbolism of some of the secret societies, the Freemasons in particular.
Yes.
They
this is something I didn't know when I began my research, but Nimrod was really huge in some of the founding myths, founding stories of the Freemasons. Some of the earliest manuscripts talk about how Nimrod, his role, and how he was the first builder, the first architect or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that much of what the Freemasons teach is designed to screen, if not obscure, the importance that Nimrod has in their beliefs and their rituals.
Yeah.
And really, when you think about it, even from a biblical perspective, we should take note of Nimrod, because the case of the Tower of Babel is the only incident, or one of the few incidents anyway, in the Bible where God himself comes down to earth and personally intervenes in human affairs. So something he was doing, Nimrod was doing, prompted Jehovah to step in and say, this stops now.
Right, right.
So talk a little bit about the Tower of Babel, Nimrod, and what it was that was so significant about that whole episode.
Now, first of all, it's very important to understand where the Tower of Babel was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And my research has shown that the Tower of Babel was more than likely in the city of Eridu. Okay.
So it goes back to the pre-flood city built by Cain.
Yes, the first city ever built. And from the very beginning, this city was a city dedicated to the god Enki.
Ah.
It was Enki's city, and it was the place where the Abzu, the abyss, was located. And Beth Vey is on to this, and she's doing a very, very good job going deeper and deeper into this whole thing. But, yes.
So what Nimrod was doing then was essentially rebuilding the ancient temple to Enki, or Satan.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Now, when we look at Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10 in the Table of Nations, it's like the text takes an interlude here to focus on one particular person, and it simply says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. He became a mighty one on the earth, and it's important here. Genesis 10 verse 10, it says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, mm-hmm. and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh and Rabbathir and Calais and Rezin, and between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Okay, what's important is the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Where is Babel? Mm-hmm. Now, in a previous interview, you hit on a very important note, which is the meaning of Babylon or Babel is Babelu, which translates as the gate of the gods.
Gate of the gods.
The gate of the gods, yes, isn't mm-hmm. it? And this has kind of connotation that where we might be thinking, Stargate or something like that.
As Beth Vey has discussed,
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So but, with more than a temple here, maybe we're talking about a literal transit point between this dimension
perhaps,
and another one, possibly.
Perhaps.
Okay.
Perhaps. Now, the gate of the gods. Now, shouldn't we look to Eridu, which was, according to the Sumerian king list, was the place where kingship descended from heaven to earth.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, there's the same kind of connotation there.
Oh,
and then
okay.
now Babylon, now the what most people see as the ancient city of Babylon is about 1,000 miles north of Eridu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that city wasn't built until about 2000 BC. And it wasn't even built by Sumerians. It was built by Amorites, and it later became the center of Hammurabi's empire.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But this was far later. Before the flood, the city of Eridu was located on the Persian Gulf,
mm-hmm.
right on the Persian Gulf. Okay? Now, what's important here is the ancient historian Berossus, he was a Babylonian high priest. He lived in Babylon at the time of the Greek takeover, when Alexander the Great, conquered almost all of Asia, or at least Asia at that time. Anyway, Berossus, in his translation of the Sumerian king lists, he simply translates Eridu as Babylon.
Hmm. Okay, so it kind of threw everybody off for a long time.
It's pretty clear cut, though, especially if you bring in what I depend on a lot is the work of David Roll. He's another British historian who has his own kind of revisionist ideas, but they make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where the Tower of Babel is located, was at Eridu, formerly on the Persian Gulf. And it was for thousands of years, it was the location, the most important location of the god Enki's temple.
Okay.
So that's the connection between Babylon and Eridu. That's where the Tower of Babel was located. Now when we go and try and find Nimrod in the Sumerian texts, it's also kind of an easy task here. Nimrod appears, after the flood, we look at the Sumerian king list. There's a list of the dynasty of Kish, and then there's a list of the dynasty of Uruk.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person on this list is a figure that David Roll believes is the biblical Cush, okay? And then it says that that this figure, Meshki Akashar, okay, is his name.
Okay.
I don't want to repeat that again, but anyway, that's his name. But the Sumerian Canaanites itself says that he left by the seas and moved to the mountains. And this is kind of what Kush did, isn't it? Leaving through the Persian Gulf and going to Africa. That's because where Kush, the land of Kush, is Ethiopia.
Right. Okay.
So now the second name on the list after Meshki Akashar is this king named Enmerkar.
Okay.
And this king Enmerkar, it says in the text that he was the one who built Uruk. Okay?
All right.
And also we see that in Genesis 10 it says that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, in other mm-hmm. words, Eridu, and Erech, or Uruk.
And isn't
okay.
it, yeah, and I've made this point before, isn't it interesting that when the Westerners divided up the land of
yes.
Iraq and gave it a name, you know, following World War I, they chose the name of the center, the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom.
Yes, they did. They
Very
named it after Nimrod's kingdom.
I'd like to learn
exactly
more about
right.
that
but
whole
they
process.
They changed the
anyway.
Spelling a little bit. If they would have spelled that E-R-E-C-H like the old King James,
right.
everybody would have known what they were trying to do.
Exactly. they kind of hit it just well enough that it's
Absolutely.
Not so obvious. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I'd like to find out a little bit more about that, how that decision was
yes,
made.
Yes, who was involved in that, who made that decision.
Right.
Yes.
So we've got... Okay, so we've got Enmerkar.
Enmerkar.
Clues
yes.
is regarding his name or anything that
his,
he did
yes.
that ties into biblical history?
Well, his name says it all, okay? David Roll looks at the basis of the Sumerian language, breaks it down phonetically. Enmer is simply three letters that can translate roughly as NMR.
Mm-hmm.
The suffix kar means hunter, okay? Enmerkar was known as Enmer the Hunter.
Enmer the Hunter.
Yes, very... Very similar to you can't dispute this.
No, the mighty hunter
Nimrod.
Before the
this
Lord.
This is Nimrod.
Yeah. Now, wasn't the prefix en also in Sumerian used to designate Lord?
Lord, yes, but yeah. I'm not sure if it the en is actually a prefix. You know, meaning is that how? In other words, should we look for Lord Mer the Hunter, or not every prefix is a prefix? In other words,
okay, all right.
Because that letter is there doesn't mean it's a. It's used as prefix,
okay,
but
yeah.
I'm not an expert on Sumerian, so I'm going.
Well, I'm definitely not. So,
but it's that'd be something interesting to look at, though. Yes.
Okay, so we've got this Enmer the Hunter, who correlates to Nimrod, the mighty hunter before
yes.
the Lord, both of whom are leading kingdoms that are based at Erech or Uruk,
yes.
in what is now southeastern Iraq, and rebuilding a temple. Well, that's what Nimrod did. Now, did Enmerkar engage in any building projects that were similar?
Absolutely. This is it's a Sumerian text known as Enmerkar and the Lord of Arata, and it talks about how it does. Enmerkar is responsible for a number of things. He's responsible for trying to rebuild the temple at Eridu. He's also responsible for introducing the worship of the goddess at Uruk. Formerly, Uruk had been a place that honored Anu. Okay.
Okay. All right.
He brought Enmerkar. The whole purpose of the Lord of the Arata epic is to bring building materials and supplies down from a mountainous kingdom to the northwest for Enmerkar to build these, to work on these projects, to build these temples. And in this epic, he gets the help of the goddess Inanna, who became known as Ishtar to the Babylonians, and who's also known as Isis to the Egyptians. But Enmerkar is very closely connected with this goddess. And another thing that Enmerkar did is supposedly, well, he's credited, at least in the myths, for the invention of writing.
Hmm. Of civilizing the world.
Yes.
Okay. Well, summing up so far, we've identified the biblical Nimrod as the historic King Enmerkar of Sumer, who introduced goddess worship into a... former center of worship devoted to the high god Anu, and rebuilt a temple devoted to the Sumerian god Enki, who Peter has identified as the biblical Satan. Is there something more to this story, and how will this all tie into end times prophecy? We will discuss that as we continue our interview with author Peter Goodgame next on PID Radio.
Peter's website is redmoonrising.com, and he's got a fine collection there of articles that he's written, not just on end times prophecy, but also analysis of the geopolitical situation in the Middle East. He's also written on the Kabbalah and its influences and sources. A lot of articles there by our friend Barry Chamish, and so just a good resource all the way around for his research and his writing. Peter Goodgame, redmoonrising.com.
It's excellent. By the way, for the last few shows, we have been teasing you with an up-and-coming contest. We're going to give a little more information today during our conspiracy series, which will be beginning about the middle of June. We are going to be offering a prize for something created out of tin foil.
Yes.
So go buy your aluminum foil, get heavy duty, get color, if you can find it.
That'd be tricky.
I know.
Yeah. And we will tell you more.
You may use Mylar if you must.
Kevlar is right out.
Hazmat, forget it. If it says Toynbee on it, you may get extra credit.
And details will be forthcoming. In the meanwhile, don't forget to take advantage of the information at our websites. And, of course, our email is always open for your questions, comments, and guest suggestions. radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And please join the forum. We'd love to have you there. It's a free-for-all. And believe me, people there are discerning. And they don't take anything we say at face value.
That's right.
And we praise God for it. So join that at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Check out the show notes for today's program at pidradio.com. And you'll find all these websites linked at the top like tabs in a file folder for your clicking convenience.
Like sands through the hourglass.
That's right. And until tomorrow, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud.